Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
I believe, and I learned very young, that you don't try to build a wall. You don't set out to build a wall. You don't say, I'm going to build the biggest, baddest, greatest wall that's ever been built. You don't start there. You say, I'm going to lay this brick as perfectly as a brick can be laid. There will not be one brick on the face of the earth that's going to be laid better than this brick that I'm going to lay in this next 10 minutes. Yeah. And you do that every single day.
And soon you have a wall.
Great, listeners, welcome back to the show once again. We've got Martin North from DFA, Digital Finance Analytics, back on the show to discuss some of the things that are happening in the economy currently. Martin, welcome back.
Hi, good to see you again.
Always, it's a pleasure, mate. Look, thanks for jumping on, mate. There were a couple of things, Martin, that I wanted to touch on today, which I thought you'll be able to give us some insights into, since you watch some of these markets very closely. One of the big events that happened this week was obviously the Fed meeting at Jackson Hole. I thought that may be a good starting point from a macro perspective, and then we can dig down into other stuff. But really wanted to see what your take was on it, and where do you see things moving forward?
Well, I think the critical speech was from Jerome Powell, right? So the Fed chair. And actually, he said very little that he hadn't said before, but it got picked up and not least had an impact on the market. But there's a bit of a change in philosophy. So what he's basically said now is that they will keep rates lower than they were perhaps thinking about previously because they're less worried about inflation. So they had this sort of 2% inflation target intended to be preemptive to try and actually make sure that the economy never ran away, right? And what he's basically said, no, we're going to change that now. We're okay if there's an overswing on employment for a period of time. Inflation because there's focus now, their critical focus is full employment. And what that basically means is that interest rates in the US will be lower for even longer. Mm-hmm. They're probably committed to more fiscal stimulus and central bank printing as part of that process. Mm-hmm. And if inflation moves into above the 2% target, that's not a worry. Now, that's significant in a way because it does actually mark a bit of a change, although they said they were going to do this last year, so it's not really dramatic. But the bond market reacted immediately saying, whoa, that means that rates are going to stay lower for longer, longer for lower. And also the other thing that happens, of course, is the exchange rate. So the Aussie has moved significantly higher. Mm-hmm. And that's a very significant issue for us, as I'll explain in a moment or two, because essentially what it basically means is that the US is going to be throwing a lot more stimulus at the economy for longer. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about inflation. So interesting question, of course, is will they be successful or will it turn into another Japan? Who knows? Mm-hmm. Some people say never bet against the Fed, and that may be true. But on the other hand, we are at an unknown phase in terms of low interest rates. And they've also said that they're not going to have interest in negative rates, right? And negative rates would be the logical next step to try and force the economy to, grow further. So they're sort of caught between this very low interest rate they've currently got, which is as low as it's ever been, right? Mm-hmm. Ability to move lower hardly at all. Mm-hmm. So it's going to keep that the same for a long period of time, but then allow the economy hopefully to spring back to life. Now, we'll see whether that works. And there are people I was reading today, people saying, oh, this is great. This will mean we'll have another boom in the US. There are other people saying, no. This is just another symptom of the fundamental problem we have economically speaking. And the fact is that the US is going to struggle for a long period of time. Now, come back to Australia. This is bad news for Australia because if the exchange rate, if our exchange rate moves up against the US, right, that means that we're going to start importing deflation. It means that any earnings made in US dollars translate to less back here. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line, ultimately, is we could well end up with a situation where our economy looks more like a deflationary-driven economy rather than inflationary-driven. Already businesses aren't investing. Well, this could mean that more businesses will not invest. It means that potentially we're going to find more small businesses also effectively conking out. So there's a whole bunch of concerns on the back of this, right? And there is a big debate, we may have touched on it before, about is the future inflationary or deflationary, right? Mm-hmm. My argument is that whilst it may appear on the surface that the Fed is signaling inflation, mm-hmm. it could have deflationary consequences for us in Australia, and that would not necessarily be a good thing, but that would actually drive our economy potentially more like to a Japanese economy where more and more of the economy is owned by the central bank, like in Japan, and yet we still have very little growth and we still have very little momentum. That's the risk that I see.
Okay, so there's a few things that you touched on that I wanted to discuss over there, some key points. So one, I'm taking a few steps back on some of the things that you mentioned. Hmm. One is more stimulus, right? More QE. So is it fair to say that the balance sheet doesn't even matter anymore, how much it grows by? Like we saw in the last couple of months, it went up by 3-4 trillion, whatever the number is, right?
Well, it looks as though they're not too worried about that. And there's an interesting debate, right? When you say printing, what really they're doing is they're shifting money from, if you like, treasury land into Fed land, right? So it's an interesting question as to whether it really is money printing. But what it does, I mean, it inflates the balance sheet. And, you know, there are people saying that, well, maybe the Fed's balance sheet, which is just a tad under 7 trillion at the moment, could actually be at 10 trillion by the time we finish. But here's the thing. The more you actually print, or the more that you shift value into the Fed's balance sheet, you've got to do it not just linearly, but logarithmically to get any impact, right? So the question is that technically feasible? Yes. Is it practically feasible? Yeah, actually it is. But will it have the response that people want? Not sure. Nobody knows. This is the biggest, it's frankly a global experiment, but it's a big experiment in the US. Nobody knows how this is going to turn out. The problem I have is I can see a path to ever lower rates, mm-hmm. but I can't see how you turn that around. I can't see how you start repaying the debt that's been created. And so we could actually end up with absolutely horrendous debt that essentially can't imagine. Look, in the UK, they put a paper out over the weekend saying we're going to have to increase taxes because we've got to find a way of being able to repay some of this higher level of debt that we've thrown at the economy to try and rescue it from COVID. So it's a question really of will it be feasible to turn this around? And frankly, nobody knows. This is a one-way street. The question is this a one-way street to a cul-de-sac? Or is there an exit? And I can't see what that exit is yet.
I was looking at some of the charts, and if you look at the velocity of money, that hasn't really moved at all. It's actually dropped. It's pretty much sitting at its rock bottom at this point, right? So, to your point, yes, they can keep adding numbers, but what is it actually doing anything? Because banks are still not lending, economy is still not performing, businesses are shutting down, which means that, and that's the reason probably velocity of money is. It's just not there.
Yeah, well, economists always used to believe that the velocity of money was a really important measure. Mm-hmm. And when you have a limited supply, true, it is. But when you have unlimited supply, which is what we've got at the moment, it's relatively meaningless, right? We know that the broad measure of money, you know, is actually higher than it's ever been. In other words, there's more money sloshing around, but it's not actually being effectively used. And that's the real problem. I think we've got to the point now where what we're doing is we're creating more money and throwing more money into the system, but it's not hitting the targets. It's not actually making businesses invest more. It's not actually helping. I mean, okay, they are encouraging more people to borrow, get ever bigger mortgages, and they're rolling up mortgages so that they're ever bigger. They're encouraging people to draw money out of super to try and spend it, and we know some of that's going on. But this is all very, very dumb policy in my view. And and so therefore, the typical indicators, which is the money supply and velocity of money, may not be that useful. What I would say is it's going also, a lot of the money is going into financial assets. I mean, if you look at the number of new people who started investing in Bitcoin or indeed stock markets, right? A lot of people got their government check and basically just, oh, I'll have a little flutter on the markets and see what I can do. And of course, at the moment, they think, oh, it's very easy, I'll put more of that. And, you know, now, unfortunately, of course, for every winner, there's a loser on this. And my argument is that we could well be in a situation where the markets correct later in the year when some of the realization of what's going on comes through, and therefore people could lose a lot of the money that's there. So that's one point. The other point is that we also know that some consumers have been spending some of their funds on, you know, more office equipment because they're working at home more, or even white goods or TVs and things. So the question is that a productive use of all that money? And the answer is no, it's not. So the problem I have is that all of this is being diluted, mm-hmm. but it's not actually focusing on the investment that we need to build a better future. And that's the thing that really concerns me. So we're going to end up with a huge amount of debt. We're going to end up with some people sitting on, you know, money that they've got, maybe saving it or maybe spending it, who knows. Mm-hmm. But it's not productive investment. And that's the problem. The strategies that are being executed at the moment, frankly, are very dumb and could lead us up to another cul-de-sac, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did mention about the currency that Aussie dollar we have noticed actually has gone up, right? Mm-hmm. So before we jump onto the Aussie side, just on the U.S., what does that mean for the currency over the long run? Now, my take is basically they are trying to, and I'm nowhere as experienced as you are, but my take is that they're trying to basically inflate their way out. Either there's two ways. One is this just defaults, sovereign defaults, or inflate out by currency manipulation, essentially, right? So devalue the currency. What is your take on the currency, the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think the U.S. dollar is being used as a international weapon, as it were, mm-hmm. to actually tilt the playing field. I think you've got to look at, for example, this in the relationship with China. I think that's part of the story there. Mm-hmm. I think also you can see that the decisions that they're taking in the U.S. is all about the U.S. And I agree there is certainly an argument for saying, well, could you actually create some inflation and therefore devalue the amount of the debt over time? That was what was done some decades ago. These very low levels, I'm less convinced that it's going to happen this time, but it's certainly a feasible argument. I think it's more that what they're trying to do is essentially kick the economy forward, but I worry that what they're doing is just perpetuating all the mistakes of the past. So, for example, we know that many corporates in the US have bought back shares because they've issued bonds, which were very low, and essentially have created zombie companies, right? None of the strategies that they're talking about changes that. We've still got many zombie companies, not just there, but all around the world. We've got companies that should, under normal capitalism, have already folded. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that we have moved away from any form of capitalism that I recognize, which is basically risk is part of capitalism. There will always be some failures. And the reason you have failures is so you can release the capital so that you can actually then invest it in more productive alternatives. Where we have now is basically the Federal Reserve saying we'll protect everybody, particularly corporates, mm-hmm. and failure is not an option. But that means you're creating all these zombie companies. So I'm not sure that those strategies will actually get us to where we want to get to mm-hmm. in any time, in any sense. But it's, again, hard to tell how it all plays out in this. You know, there are so many moving parts. We've never had the same negative feedback loops existing in so many countries at the same time. Look at, you know, the US, the UK, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, wherever you look, you've got the same issues. So, mm-hmm. and it's also worth highlighting that the amount of money that is flowing into the system from all the central banks has never been higher. And the amount of debt in the system has never been higher. And the inflation has never been lower. Draw your own conclusions.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's interesting. It's all an experiment that is happening at this point.
It's a huge experiment, and it's one without any instructions on the packet. Mm-hmm. Right. And frankly, the experiment started more than a decade ago, and it failed for the first 10 years. The question is, why would it not continue to fail? What's different this time? Mm-hmm. Just doing the same money bigger is what they're doing. Yeah. And I don't see any logic as to why just doing more of the same is actually going to have a different outcome. You know, insanity is defined as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. Well, I'm afraid it's insanity because I think we're going to get the same outcome.
Mm-hmm. Now, we all, and you mentioned it before as well, we talk a lot about Japanification of the US, and you mentioned Australia as well, right? Now, and this is something we discussed last week between John, I, and David, that the difference between Japan and the Western world is that Japan had their own savings, right? So they own their debt, whereas the Western world, whether it's US or Australia, there's a lot of credit out there, right? Hmm. This is where I get confused a little bit, is basically why I mean, it's not exactly Japanification. It's, yes, it's heading down the path, but what about the savings, which no one talks about?
So the question is, was the savings the thing that created the Japanization? The answer is no, right? That was always there. They've always been that way. I mean, there is a different structure to the Japanese economy where they make a lot more stuff, so they can sell it abroad. But the whole strategy of taking rates really low, buying assets, you know, stock market assets and all sorts of other assets by the central bank to try and get inflation and failing, going to negative interest rates, that's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those parameters are quite similar to what we might see here. So to my mind, that's a red herring, arguing that somehow the Japanese economy is somehow structurally different and therefore we can't replicate it. And look, Europe, look at the EC. Mm-hmm. They have got negative interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
They have got huge amounts of bank debt. Mm-hmm. They have got quantitative easing and they're going the same way. So if it were just Japan, I would say maybe there's something unique about Japan, but because Europe's going down the same way already, and we've got many countries in Europe with negative rates, this is more structural. And therefore I think those fundamental parameters are likely to be very similar here too.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, and New Zealand has done a lot of talk lately about negative rates. I think they're already preparing their toolkit around that. Do you see this inevitable in America and in Australia? Although the RBA out here has said a few times that no to negative rates. Do you think it's inevitable or... like we said before, it's uncharted waters. It's impossible to...
Well, the Reserve Bank said they don't want to do it here, but they might. So they left the door slightly open. Last year, they said they'd never do it. So they are moving in that direction. New Zealand is the most overt and transparent example of a central banker, Adrian Orr, saying we are actively considering it. It's part of the toolkit. They're also doing, of course, bigger amounts of QE and those things. They're basically throwing all the tools. Now, I think they're being most transparent, and I have to say that I respect the Reserve Bank of New Zealand for their transparency and openness. It's a characteristic of New Zealanders and New Zealand in general, and I applaud that. In Australia, we are much less likely to be telling what we're really thinking, so we sort of position and what have you, right? In the US, though, the Federal Bank is not a public company. It's owned privately by all the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And all the banks, of course, have terrible trouble when rates go negative. So there's a reason why the central bank in the US is saying we don't want to go into negative rates because it would kill the profitability of their members, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas central banks who are owned by, if you like, the public or by the government, depending on how you look at the structure, right, will be more willing to go that route. And so my expectation is New Zealand is probably likely to do it. I think there's a significant chance that Australia will be forced to do it down the track.
Mm-hmm.
Won't have any effect, though. It won't have any positive impact other than making it even clearer that the economy is broken.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at where negative interest rates have been running, like in Japan and in the EC, that's had no impact. It's had no positive effect at all. And that is because people and businesses will only borrow more if they are confident of the future and if they're confident that they're able to invest for a return.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is there's so much money sloshing around now looking for a home. And there are so many businesses who are not interested because they can't see that the risks are too high. So fundamentally, I think it's a flawed strategy. I'm sure it will be tried. It will fail. And it will be another example of this old theory of the way the economy works being proved to be wrong.
That's fascinating. It's interesting.
It is uncharted waters. There's no rule book. There's no handbook on how to do this. But of course, all the central bankers are group thinking because they're all talking to each other and they're all sort of following the same neoliberal path.
Mm-hmm.
But that neoliberal path doesn't necessarily end well.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't end well, particularly for you and me and ordinary people, you know, people with mortgages, people with businesses, because what they're doing is they're worrying about the financial stability and the financial system. They're not worrying about the real economy.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's true both of the central bankers and their hangers-on, and most governments as well. All of the lip service about supporting the economy and supporting small business is a million miles from what they're actually doing. And that's the problem. Everybody's focused on the big end of town, fixing the financial stability question, rather than the real question, which is how do you fix the real economy?
Interesting. So what is your take based on currently what's going on within the Australian economy? I'm in Victoria. We have seen a second lockdown that happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Assume that this is the last lockdown. We won't see another one after this, right?
Well, you don't know. You can't say that. You don't know how the virus is going to play, right? So if they are successful in close to eliminating and they actually do some gentle openings and we don't get a massive bounce up again, maybe. But if we get thousands and thousands of infections again, as is possible, there could well be another lockdown. We don't know. We can't tell until the virus is closed out. And I keep saying to people, you cannot talk about an economic survival and recovery until you've got the virus fixed, because the virus is the critical barrier between that, right? So I don't know. It may, you know, maybe they will gently be able to open, but of course Victoria is already well below. So there are more small businesses failing in Victoria, according to my surveys. There are more households in mortgage stress in Victoria as a result of what's gone on. Mm-hmm. And of course the ramifications are broader for the overall Australian economy as well. And by the way, there's no chance of us opening international borders until the virus is relatively locked down in every geographic area of Australia. So that's another reason why it's important that Victoria gets their act together and gets it under control. But there's no guarantee here. And of course, if you look at what's happening with infection rates and R0 numbers, they're going up in New South Wales at the moment, and there are infections in Queensland as well. So it's all a very unknown country again.
Mm-hmm. Now, you watch the mortgage numbers, I know, very closely, Martin, right? What are you seeing in that space, and what are the, are there any risk? Because I saw an article that came out, I think it was yesterday or the day before, where there was a stress test done on banks again, and even with the 40% decrease in the prices, banks, according to the article, shouldn't be impacted with the changes that were made a few years ago. What are you seeing based on your analysis, and what's your take?
Okay, so the 2 points there. The first is that RBA paper was not completely accurate, because they used data from about 3 years old. They used a survey of 17,000 participants, which is a very low number. And they made a classic error, which is that the debt is distributed to those who are more affluent, and they've assumed that the unemployment rates among those more affluent aren't going to go wrong. None of that's true. So I completely reject that paper and the way it was put together. It was done more for optics than truth. Mm-hmm. The truth is that the data sets that I see are showing that there is considerably more mortgage stress. There are considerably more defaults bubbling along. The banks are already forcing some borrowers to try and sell the property as they come to the end of their period of capital and repayment holidays. We also know that some people who started to repay have suddenly discovered that their mortgage repayments have gone up because the banks haven't extended the term of the loan. They've just increased it, increased the payments. This is a terrible indictment on our banking system and a terrible risk to the economy. You know, there's more than 1,500, sorry, if I get that right, more than 1.5 million. There's more than 1.5 million households in mortgage stress, of more than 3 million who actually have a mortgage. So it's about 40.01% of households in mortgage stress. Mortgage stress leads to lots of issues, and it's being driven by the income shock, the unemployment shock, cost of living, and all those things. And that's the critical thing. Unemployment is the thing to watch, right? RBA is saying 10% by the end of this year and maybe down to 7% in 2 years' time. That level of unemployment will absolutely lead to more defaults. And what we're seeing now is structural unemployment. We're seeing unemployment at the more top end of town. We're looking at in the finance sector and the consulting sector. Those are big people with big jobs, big incomes, big mortgages, big risks. So to me, this is just in the foothills. And in the US and in the UK, it took 3 to 4 years for all of that to work through to be able to actually reach the peak of the collapse, which basically was a 30% fall in house prices and significant defaults 3 to 4 years later. So we're only in the foothills of this whole cycle.
But then on the other hand, Martin, if there is stimulus being provided to the economy, which can lead to the inflation in the asset prices, right? So what does that mean for the property prices? Because there's two forces going in the opposite direction, pushing the property prices in the opposite direction, right? So where does that go, basically?
Yeah, well, maybe there is, maybe there isn't. So we, what we do know is that the demand for property is easing. We know that there are more people looking to sell than previously from my surveys. We know that many property investors are saying, I can't make this work. Mm-hmm. So that's the first, force. The second force is that the overseas buyers have left the market. You know, all the barriers, it's hard to make that turnaround anytime soon. The government is encouraging, bribing, I would say, first-time buyers to go buy those homeland packages. That's more to help the construction sector than actually help the property sector. So the prices in my modeling are going down. The question is how much down? And all of that extra money that's being thrown around the place, right, it's going into financial assets, sure. It's going into stock markets, sure. How much is going to property? Not as much as previously. And that's because the forward outlook for property prices is much more bearish than it has been. And many people are saying now is the time not to buy.
If the JobKeeper and the JobSeeker packages that are due, I think the extension is up to the March at this point, right? And then they're going to relook at it. But assuming that the JobKeeper, JobSeeker packages end at that time, right, around that time, how do you see, what's your take post that? I mean, we already know with the businesses are impacted, right? So the small businesses, restaurants, a lot of the restaurants are closing down. They probably won't open up again. Some are already in losses, blah, blah, blah. Where does that take us, basically?
Yeah, no, well, that's a good question. And look, just to sort of give a little bit of a sense here, in the last quarter, there was more than 100 billion of stimulus from all the various categories, which was about 25% of GDP. Okay? Mm-hmm. In the next quarter, it goes from that to about 7% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
The quarter after that, it goes to about 2% of GDP. Right? Mm-hmm. So there's a massive fall of that stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that it's going to be hugely and critically a shock event for the economy, because a lot of people are spending because they've got the money to spend, as we've discussed earlier, right? That's not going to happen now. The unemployment is still rising and will continue to rise for some time. Mm-hmm. So unless the government changes its strategy and keeps more stimulation running for longer,
mm-hmm.
my view is that all they've done is just postpone the inevitable, and actually they've made it worse, because what they've done is going back to this argument about capitalism, if in fact they've supported companies that should have folded, if they've actually, as they've done, abolished bankruptcy so nobody can actually, basically fail, and that directors won't be accountable if they're are trading when they shouldn't be trading, all of those changes of the rules, and APRA said, well, actually those bad loans aren't bad loans. Mm-hmm. They've moved all the parameters to try and actually keep the economy going on the assumption that it was going to be a big bounce back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember the discussion about, you know, the bounce back and the bridge to the other side?
Mm-hmm.
Funny how that's suddenly gone now, because that bridge looks extremely long now. It looks it's probably one of the biggest bridges around. So the point is, we've got a much longer crisis. U-shaped, if you're hopeful. Mm-hmm. L-shaped, in other words, down and then flat, if you're not hopeful. I'm somewhere between U and L. It's definitely not V.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, with the virus, it could be W, because, open, close, all of those shapes are there. But the point is, the amount of stimulus that we've got at the moment, which is huge, as it's taken away, will absolutely continue to take the carpet out from the economy. I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to see significant and substantive momentum. And I mentioned that exchange rate move, that's going to have another negative impact too. Mm-hmm. So all of the factors look to me as though we're in for a long, slow grind,
mm-hmm.
not just over a few months, but over 2 to 3 to 5 years. One of the reasons why I still believe house prices will fall further. And the overall economic performance of Australia looks to me to be highly suspect. Now, China may help to save us if we can actually continue to ship out lots of iron ore. But, of course, China's now started to play hardball on other trade-related issues. So that might be something which gets compressed. Mm. If we have continued negative activity in many other countries, demand for our products and services may actually be less as well. Mm. So unless we focus on building capability and building value here in Australia and investing in those businesses that we should be investing in for the future, the danger that I see is we end up with an economy that is weaker and less able to thrive and survive, and that's bad for everybody in Australia. Unfortunately, the conversation we should be having about laying those foundational investments and, for example, creating a national bank that can invest in infrastructure in big time here, right, in Australia, those sorts of things, those are not the conversations that are being had there, the conversation that should be had. Instead, what we're doing is we're going back to the old neoliberal view of we've got to actually get the budget back in surplus, you know, blah, 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 right? And we'll reduce the stimulus as much as we can. Those strategies, I'm afraid, were found out previously. And just reverting to, as the Treasurer said a couple of weeks ago, you know, the Thatcher ideology, right? That really worries me. We need to find a new path, right? A path into a different future, but one where we actually are building more stuff here, where we have more businesses that want to invest here. I was talking to somebody yesterday who runs a small business, and he said, it's not feasible for me to actually get somebody as an apprentice to come and work with me because I train them up, they disappear. So it's a waste of money for me to do that. So that there's got to be different structural imperatives put in place to help small businesses grow and develop, to help people to be more innovative and to create more capability onshore, rather than just being, frankly, the house and homes economy, where basically we just put all our eggs in the housing basket and we dig up holes out of the ground and just throw minerals out internationally. We need a different path.
Yeah, definitely. Totally agree on that. More innovation and entrepreneurship. Yep. But just before we move on to some of the other stuff, which is the exchange rate and all, and maybe treasury bonds as well, just finish off on property. Okay. Now, I had a lot of experts on the show who have talked about commercial property will really get hammered, and the chances of or the recovery that we will see in that space will be very staggered kind of thing, where some of the commercial properties will recover, whereas others, like some of the offices in the shared offices in the CBD and all, they're not going to come back. And speaking to some of these experts, they have talked about a shift towards the more fringes of the city and the country towns to some extent. I know you crunched some numbers on the commercial side as well. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, well, it's clear that you have to go sector by sector. We know retail is going to be really, really taken to the cleaners. We've got much more vacant property for retail than we've probably ever had. There's also a lot of new stuff being built where you've got these high rises with retail strips on the ground floor. None of those necessarily being taken up. So retail is an issue. The office area in the CBDs definitely will be less needed than previously. There will still be a need to have probably presence in the CBD, but much smaller. So maybe shared offices, maybe smaller footprints. That means we've got a lot of office accommodation that probably is going to go begging for some time or much lower rates.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, people are working at home more and people are interested in perhaps working in some of the more regional areas. And the virus has indicated that it is feasible to do things remotely like we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved down out of Sydney a decade ago into a more regional area and never been happier. You know, don't have all the hassles of transport, the hassles of lots of people. And of course, the virus is less raging down here than it is in the central town. So I think we're in a very significant shift, and that's partly being driven by digitalization. It's partly being driven by demographics. It's partly being driven by the response to the virus. Mm-hmm. I think we have to be much more ingenious about thinking about the new business models and the way that businesses are going to work. But I think that a lot of commercial sector real estate is going through the floor, and some of the real estate trusts are still very, very frankly very risky, and although people are buying into them still, I think that's probably a mistake.
Fair enough. Moving on to the next topic, Martin, you already touched on this exchange rate. Obviously, Australian exchange rate has gone up and it can have its impact on the economy, right? For the time being, obviously, we are seeing the rate go up. Do you see that happening over the long run, being sustainable? I mean, in the past, we have seen RBA doing things like rate cuts and all to bring the exchange rate down a bit, right? But that is not even practical anymore for obvious reasons. Yep. So what's your take on that?
Well, the Reserve Bank should be concerned about an exchange rate of above 70. There are people saying it'll be around 75, maybe even as high as 80. I've heard a few people say it could breach parity with the US dollar. I'm not sure it'll go that high. Mm-hmm. But those are significant moves. And, of course, as I said earlier on, you imported deflation, right, by mm-hmm. doing that. Mm-hmm. And what it also means is it's much harder to compete as well. So this is a very, very big and risky issue. The Reserve Bank would love the exchange rate to be lower because that is the thing that has previously helped to insulate us from some of those international pressures. But at the moment, it's going in the other direction. The question is, what can they do about it? Because they could, you know, basically try and go into the markets directly and buy and sell Aussie dollars to try and move the rate, but that huge amount of effort required and, of course, money to do that, so that's not going to work. They could look to take rates low. One of the reasons why I think negative interest rates, as we discussed, is not completely off the cards. But I don't think that will necessarily have a huge impact on the exchange rate because rates are so low at the moment. And it comes back to, well, will international investors decide that Australia is a good place to invest or not? And the answer is it rather depends on what we do because, you know, whilst Australia is seen as a safe place to invest at the moment, it's not necessarily that productive to invest and the exchange rate doesn't actually help. So there are lots of risks. There are lots of concerns. And remember that we have a big international debt exposure. And that's something else that people need to think about because that debt has to ultimately be repaid and that's going to cost. So whichever way you look at it, this is bad news.
Mm-hmm. Good enough. Now, when you say deflation, you mean deflation in the prices of the goods, or do you mean deflation in the asset prices, or both?
Well, both and. So the model goes like this: the stock markets reach a height, they then effectively are unable to maintain that height, and then they start to decline again. Right. At the same time, the confidence that was there driving it higher goes away. As a result of that, we start seeing people getting into difficulty. We start seeing defaults on property and particularly corporate bonds, which is where it's going to start, I think. Once that happens, then effectively the deflationary forces go around. So you have higher unemployment, you have lower prices, you have no wage growth. No wage growth means you effectively are able to buy less, so therefore you have less GDP, so you find that the negative spiral goes. So it's all the factors effectively that drove the economy positively turned negative right at the same time. So it's not just asset prices, it's normal prices, it's wages, it's jobs. And so you end up potentially with an economy that's shrinking, with interest rates that are very low, with wages going negative rather than positive growth. And all of those factors then will have a negative impact on housing sector because more people will default in their houses. That means that more people will need to sell their properties. That means that prices will fall. That will have a reinforcing negative feedback because, of course, the wealth effect is a negative. So it's like you can't separate one thing out and say that's going to be the problem. It's all interconnected, right? It's one of the reasons why my market model is so complicated because it models or tries to model all the various elements within the economy and then sort of say, well, if this changes, then that changes, if that changes, then something else changes. So it's all connected.
Moving on to the next one, bond yields.
Yep.
Based on the Fed meetings and some of the things that we discussed, where do you see bonds moving forward and your overall thoughts on it?
Well, the bond rates will stay lower for longer. We saw the bond yields, react to the Fed's news. So the long term, particularly, basically indicated that rates will be lower for a lot longer. So I think the rates will be extremely low for an extremely long period of time. There are quite rightly people saying the bonds are the things to watch because once you actually understand what's happening there, you can get a much better read on the overall economy. I think that's right. Rates impossibly low for impossibly long length of time. I don't know that anybody knows how to turn it around. So therefore, I expect that to be the case. Therefore, bond yields, might actually look quite interesting for a period of time. Maybe even less risky than some other markets, but we'll have to wait and see, I guess. But the critical thing I'd call is that the bond markets are signaling one thing, the exchanges and stock markets are signaling something else. I trust the bond market more than I trust the share markets. The share markets are overvalued. They will correct. It's only a matter of when. It's timing rather than actually it never happening. It will happen. And when it does happen, a lot of people will lose their shirts, particularly those new investors we discussed earlier on who basically piled in and thought it was easy money because it isn't.
Now, when you say bond market is signaling one thing and the stock market is signaling another thing, can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. So basically, the bond markets are saying interest rates are going to be very low for a very long period of time, right? In other words, the economy is not going to be performing particularly well for a long period of time, right? Mm-hmm. the stock markets, because of the price of the stock markets, are saying, no, 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 no. In a few months' time, companies will be creating massive amounts of returns. Therefore, you know, we can buy even more stocks, right? So who's right, right? Mm-hmm. Is the economy relatively flat, frozen, solid for the next 5 to 6 years, or is it going to boom as the stock markets will be signaling based on the prospective returns? Remember that in theory, at least, stock mm-hmm. markets are discounting future cash flows and giving a price, right? Mm-hmm. Of the two, I trust bond markets much more than I trust the share markets.
Mm-hmm. Now, Warren Buffett was out last week. Obviously, Berkshire has bought gold mining stocks, which has never happened in the past. Their safest bet normally is the treasury bonds, but this time it has been a little bit different. What does that tell you?
Well, there's two things. One is he sold a lot of banks, mm-hmm. right? Warren Buffett selling banks, that's significant in my view, very significant. Mm-hmm. And I'm of the same view. I think banks are still overvalued and they will go down in value because of all the things we've discussed.
Mm-hmm. And that's just in the US or in Australia as well?
Both and. Mm-hmm. And stock prices of banks in Australia never recovered to where they did in the US. They're still somewhere between 20 and 40% down from their peaks previously, depending on which one you look at. Mm-hmm. They're still overvalued. They've got huge bad debts to deal with ahead. Mm-hmm. In terms of Buffett and his gold, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. He bought miners rather than gold itself, which mm-hmm. tells you something, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess he's thinking that there's going to be long-term demand for gold. What I'd say about gold miners is that they're not all the same. And people don't understand that you need to actually do the work on the individual miners to understand about their individual prospects rather than just buying the sector, because that's the stupidest way to try and make money that I've ever heard of. But people are doing that at the moment. So I guess they've probably done a bit of work to understand why it is that that particular stock is the one that they're actually attracted to. And, you know, he does take long-term bets mm-hmm. based on his analysis and, you know, the firm's analysis of what is going on. So that makes perfect sense to me. So that's mm-hmm. the way I read it. But I think it's very significant that he didn't buy gold, he bought miners. Mm-hmm.
One last question that I have, Martin, is you did a recent interview with Stefan Levera, who yep. runs Bitcoin podcast. Now, I know in the past you have said that you're not really a believer in Bitcoin. Has anything changed?
Well, that's not really what I've said. What I've said is uh-huh. I'm not a believer in the speculative nature of Bitcoin. Okay. Right? Mm-hmm. I do believe that the blockchains and the digital world is definitely one which we need to be watching, and it will create major opportunities ahead. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a speculative investor in Bitcoin. There's a fundamental difference.
Fair enough. But has anything changed since that interview?
No, nothing. Not really. I mean, I still believe, and whether it's Bitcoin or whether it's one of the other ones, or, you know, who knows. But the fundamental potential of digitalization mm-hmm. and being able to do things, you know, electronically using these new capabilities is huge, right? And it's the blockchains, and it's the, you know, ability to be able to decentralize. Those are the real critical value creating activities. I'm not sure whether it'll be Bitcoin or whether it'll be one of the other ones. You know, there's an interesting debate about that. But the point is, you can't just ignore it and say, no, 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 there's nothing going on here, right? I don't know that's what I say is, I am not an outright speculator on the future direction of Bitcoin, because there's no way you can work out what it's worth, right? It could go higher, it could go lower. There's no rhyme or reason to it. But the fundamental capabilities that digital offers are huge in terms of efficiency, productivity, innovation, new capabilities, all those things. And that's why I'm interested in what's going on. And I noticed that the number of large financial players and other organizations are now much more actively involved in and around those capabilities. And therefore, I think we're going to see new innovations. And I don't know whether it'll be Bitcoin or whether it will be Libra or whether it will be, you know, something else that will ultimately take a place, or whether it will be a constellation. My own belief is it'll probably be a constellation of different solution sets for different purposes. But no, I'm very excited by what digital can do. Mm-hmm. But as for Bitcoin as a particular speculative asset, well, it's probably more speculative in gold, and I regard gold as relatively speculative as well for other reasons.
Awesome. Anything else that you would like to add, Martin, since we last, I think we last had you 2 or 3 months ago on the podcast. Obviously, a few things have happened since then. Anything else that you would like
to add? Well, I just say this, that there are many households who are experiencing huge financial pressures that they've never experienced before. Mm-hmm. And one of my observations from my surveys is that many people go into what I call head in the hole position. In other words, they just ignore it, right? Mm-hmm. What I would say is that it is very important now, because of where we are and because this is going to be a long drag of an economic crisis, that people actually wake up and begin to take some notice and account of their financial position. Mm-hmm. And don't assume that this is magically going to fix itself. So I think it's very important for people to think about their cash flow, to think about their financial position and financial stress. I say that because I spoke to Eddie Hobbs, who was a guy over in Ireland there a decade plus ago, and he made the point to me some time ago, this is way before the crisis was, understand that we're not in a financial crisis. What we're actually in is a social and economic crisis, and it's a social crisis because financial crises lead to broader social consequences, and be that, family violence, or be that, frankly, even suicides and those sorts of things. So my observation is, we should think of this more broadly than just a financial issue that we should be talking about. We should be talking about some of the social consequences, and we should alert people to the fact that if you are getting yourselves into difficulty, it's actually worth reaching out and getting help and advice early. Don't just assume magically that things are going to spring back and everything will be fine, because unfortunately, financial pressure can lead to social pressure and consequences. And that's the thing that I'm most concerned about, that we have yet to understand the full social implications of the financial crisis that we're in the middle of.
Mm-hmm. I think especially for the first home buyers and the owner of buyers who are purchasing their first or second home, it generally you get carried away and end up spending more money than
I may have said before, but I'll say it again. It amazes me how people spend more time researching the purchase of a car than they do when they buy a house. I mean, it is remarkable because, you know, the house is an emotional transaction as much as a financial transaction. But at this time, be cautious, be careful, do some modeling, think about alternative scenarios, ask yourself what happens if, in fact, wages dry up or if jobs disappear. Mm-hmm. Because the danger is that you can actually assume that if the bank says, yeah, sure, have a mortgage, that you can afford the mortgage, right? Mm-hmm. And they're only interested in their interests. They're not interested in your interests, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really important that people actually do the work and think it through. And mm-hmm. I would be very cautious at the moment. Frankly, prices are not going to bubble away in terms of houses. You can afford to wait and take time. But the broader point is those who are already in financial difficulty, in mortgage stress or whatever, or rental stress, right? Mm-hmm. Reach out, try and tackle these issues early, because the more you let it fester, the more dangerous it becomes. And that's the concern I'd have.
Mm-hmm. Now, I took a bet with Steve Keen about a year and a half ago on property prices. His point of view was that the prices will crash by 40%, and it's pretty well known, Steve. And he's a very, very smart guy, without a doubt. And I think he probably would have been right if there was no job keeper, job seeker. Are you in his camp still? Or
no, well, I run scenarios, right? So I don't definitively say prices will drop 40%. I've never said that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I get misquoted often. What I said was, here was a range of scenarios. At the top end, if the virus gets fixed, if they do the right things, we might see a 5 to 10 or 15% correction over the next 3 years, right? Mm-hmm. If things go really badly and the economy continues to fall over and we get a second wave, then we could be looking at 20 to 30%, right? My middle point is somewhere in between. But remember this, property is fundamentally overvalued by at least 40%. Mm-hmm. Against long-term trends, whether you look at income, whether you look at GDP or other metrics. So we are in bubble territory. And so the question is, how much longer will the bubble go on? How much will it actually deflate? And where will it end up? And that, again, goes back to my scenario. So my expectation is prices will fall. I think over the next 3 years, on average, they could be down 20 or maybe even 30%, units more than houses, different regions moving at different cases. You've got to go granular, actually, because you can't just talk macro. But I am also with Steve, which is that the Fed in the US the Reserve Bank here, they will throw everything they can. The government will try and throw money at this so that when they go to the election the next year, prices won't have slid too far. Mm-hmm. Remember what I said? We're talking a 3-year minimum sort of cycle down.
Yeah.
Prices will be lower in a year or two than they are today, in my view.
Martin, always, like always, appreciate your time. People love listening to you, obviously. You're a very knowledgeable person and you're in the space that you are. We'll probably touch back soon again once things change, which they are changing pretty fast, and rediscuss what's on the table at the time.
Right. Yeah, well, great to chat with you. And, you know, I like talking about these integrated issues because the chances are of being able to stitch a picture together, right? And that's really important because just diving into one particular topic without understanding how it all fits together is like the old definition, you know, of the butterfly flaps over here, but you need to understand how it flows through into other things. So thanks for the opportunity.
Right, all good, man. We'll touch base soon. I wanted to touch on spot lines as well, but we're probably running out of time for that, so we'll do that next time.
Yeah, well, they're less used at the moment, so we can leave that for now.
Awesome. To the listeners, hope you guys enjoyed it, and we'll see you guys next time.